This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, June 14th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. I'm not in a studio. I'm in a park. I am observing frolicsome children. My own. You know the admonishment, hug your family closer after a tragedy? I decided to take the admonishers up on it. But that doesn't mean that I've not been in tune with what's going on. I heard President Obama today talking about the idea that if he would just say radical Islam, then perhaps there'd be no radical Islam. Here the president is. Somehow I could cue the sound from the park. Here the president is talking about that.
That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. What exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to trying to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? The answer is none of the above. Calling a threat by a different name does not make it go away.
Now, this idea that we could abracadabra away our problems, it's clearly nonsense. And it's nonsense for all the reasons the president said, but it's just nonsense on the face of it. The one thing that the president has done by not saying radical Islam is he's forestalled the inevitable process where that phrase gets changed to something and then something else, right? First it's conservation, then it's energy independence, then it's alternative energy. So if we were saying radical Islam, yeah, it would piss off our allies in the Jordanians and conflate the situation, but we'd be three phrases past that. Although sometimes I wonder, what if it were true? What if it were true that but for the pronouncement of a phrase, we could solve a problem, like the pet overpopulation problem? Perhaps it is true that just one phrase would show that we understand it and cut through all the red tape that's been gumming up our solving of the pet overpopulation problem. That phrase, lustful chihuahuas. He can't even say lustful chihuahuas. How does he understand the problem? Well, even though I am in a park and I am hugging my kids closer, I'm also embracing you, just listeners, by giving you a full show. We have John D. Domenico on. He's the guy who plays Trump on the Trump cast. We talk about impersonations in general. But first, it's a postcard about the post office. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Devin Leonard has written, I'm going to call it the definitive history of the United States Postal Service, one of those books that you didn't know you wanted to read until you're halfway through and you're like, oh my God, I never knew. It's called Neither Snow Nor Rain, A History of the U.S. Postal Service. And what we're going to do is break it up into bite-sized pieces. I'm calling them postcards. And today's postal postcard is the thing I think that captivated me most in the book, the history of the post office and slavery. Two, one for good, one for absolute ill, American institutions. So Devin, you start with, if you start talking about the United States Post Office, a great starting point is Benjamin Franklin. And he had thoughts about how the postal system would affect this peculiar institution, slavery.
No, you're right, Mike. I mean, and basically what Franklin wanted to do was unify the, you know, the American colonies, you know, at the time. And he thought that the mail system would, you know, enable Americans to communicate with each other and sort of create their own culture. He wasn't even thinking about pulling away from Britain at that point. But of course, he did get there eventually. So he was thinking about unifying Americans, but also enabling them to exchange information like newspapers and things like that, which the Europeans didn't do. So he was trying to get us all together and also, you know, make people think more. And inevitably, to do that, you know, led to breaking with Britain and freedom for America. So that's kind of where the Postal Service starts.
And he thought it was inevitable that if materials were freely shared in the mail, this institution of slavery would die, would wither, because this was the faith he had in the intellect. And to him, the post office was an offshoot of just, you know, being an aware and informed person in the world.
Well, then it wasn't just him. It was, you know, a fair amount of Northerners thought that, you know, basically, if you have the free circulation through the mail of, you know, of information, slavery, you know, can't survive. But of course, you know, it did survive despite this great postal service that he created.
Well, the postal service then did enact rules that were specifically enacted to try to propagate slavery. Could you tell me about that?
Well, no. That's the fascinating thing is that, it also sort of speaks to Thomas Jefferson's Postmaster General Gideon Granger started thinking, hey, if we let Black Americans, both enslaved and free Americans, if they start exchanging mail, and also, you know, if you have Black letter carriers sort of riding around and talking to people, then they'll all get together and they'll rebel. There'll be a race war. And there was an example of that, which was Haiti.
Haiti had a slave rebellion. And he said what we'd be doing is creating a norm of a Black person, a postmaster, sort of at the dissemination point of information. And that would be really dangerous. And therefore, the rule was no Black letter carriers.
Right. And again, free or enslaved, they can't touch the mail because, you know, this is just going to cause all kinds of problems.
And that was on the books until the Civil War. And did abolitionists try to use the mail?
Well, yeah, and they did. And some people call this the first direct mail campaign. It was in the 1830s. There were a bunch of Northern abolitionists. They sent tons and tons and tons of abolitionist literature to southern post offices, and they got the names of, you know, of all these sort of prominent people, and they sort of flooded the Southern Post with all of this material, and a lot of it went to Charleston, South Carolina, and people got wind of it, and a mob broke into the post office in South Carolina, and they burned the mail, they burned all these abolitionists, including William Garrison, the famous abolitionist, they burned him in effigy, and the Jackson administration wanted to ban that material from the mail, but even Southern senators, they wouldn't go for that because they thought that was, you know, federal government overreaching.
So. Right. So John C. Calhoun winds up, I mean, just because of strange politics, but he was so anti-Jackson's dictatorial tendencies as well as being a slave owner that you have Calhoun standing up for the abolitionist right to
free speech.
Yeah. Crazy. So, you know, after the Civil War, what's been the history of the post office and African Americans?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a very proud history because, it's an institution that hired a lot of Blacks and Hispanics and enabled them to move up into the middle class. And so in that sense, it's been a great equalizer. But there have been some other stains, on the Postal Service in its history under Woodrow Wilson, Albert Burleson, who was the Postmaster General. he was a supporter of segregation, and he wanted to segregate the federal workforce and didn't want blacks in post offices, and he wanted them in places like the dead letter office where they wouldn't be seen. So that's a shameful moment, even though the Postal Service is seen as a great force in helping minorities move into middle class.
This is a little off the point of what this postcard is about, but in saying that, you remind me that the post office is so often a touchstone for the president and his personality. I mean, it's a federal office, a federal appointee, it's quasi-cabinet right. position. And so to take Woodrow Wilson, who's this noted racist, yeah, he's going to be racist in the post office. To take FDR, think about what the fireside chats were. He was trying to do a similar thing with the post office, like use stamps as a way to tell a story of America. That is consistent in the history of the post office.
Well, that's
and Jackson, as we said, a dictator. He wanted to clamp down on the post office.
And also, the Postal Service was a great sort of patronage mill. And so usually what a president would do was he would put his, campaign manager in charge of the post office. And part of his job was making sure the mail got delivered, but it was also finding jobs for all of your, campaign workers and stuff. So everybody did that up into 1970. But FDR's Postmaster General James Farley, he basically rebuilt the Democratic Party and turned it into this huge machine, largely through postal patronage. So.
Yeah, and Farley Post Office is the one where we have the epigram on top: "Neither snow nor rain, Herodotus." For the rest of the quote, go look at 34th and 8th Avenue for the book. It's called "Neither Snow Nor Rain: A History of the United States Post Office," and Devin Leonard is its author. Thank you for this postcard, Devin.
Sure, thanks, Mike.
So we're sitting here with a very famous and impressive American. I think you know the voice.
Hello, everybody. I am so happy to be on this show. It's really, really fantastic. I have to tell you.
That is Donald J. No, it's not. It's John DiDomenico. If you listen to Trump Cast, and you should, he does the Trump impression. He's the in-house Trump impressionist on Trump Cast, and he does just about the best Trump impression out here. And I was out in the hall talking to him, and I'm like, these are so many good questions I'd love to ask if I had my own podcast and a studio and a microphone, and wait, I do. So I'm going to ask you a couple of these questions. But first, let's talk about Trump. Before he became a national political figure, were you doing impressions of him?
I've been doing Trump for 12 years. Mm-hmm. So I've been since 2002, since the end of the very first season of The Apprentice. I got a call for a voiceover. I actually went out and bought that first season. I sat down for about 30 hours and I cracked his voice, and I went in and did the audition on that Monday and I got the booking.
Now, I listened to – I once heard a great interview. It was on the Dennis Miller Show, and they had – Dana Carvey and Frank Caliendo.
Caliendo. Yeah, Frank's amazing. And so is Dana.
Right. And they were talking shop. And I think they had slightly different methods. But what Dana does is he finds a way in. And usually it's a person he can do tweaked a little bit. So the best example that he gives is that his George W. Bush's Mr. Rogers mixed with a little John Wayne. Is that one of the methods you use to nail a voice?
Yes. Except for Trump, I couldn't figure out a way in. No one else was doing him. Mm-hmm. Usually I'll listen to somebody else, like, how is this person doing this? But with Trump, I did it much more scientifically. I sat down and I wrote out. I broke it down. There's usually five to eight elements. There's throat placement, nasal placement, vocal production, cadence, and I always call it the secret sauce. It's like when you do Austin Powers, baby. He's very up, baby. Yeah. So he's – So with Trump, it's much more of an attitudinal kind of thing. He said, what are you talking about? He can just, get out of here, go away, you're fired.
So you were tasked with Trump as a gig. What percentage of your impressions, or someone asked you to do an impression, and what percentage are you just hear someone either a lot or a little and you're like, I think I could nail this? You do it on your own.
The overwhelming majority is when people ask me to do it. It's a couple of years ago, Guy Fieri became popular with Diner Drive. Well, actually, it was Minute to Win It. So my corporate client said, hey, are you doing Guy Fieri yet? And I was like, hold on, baby. Let me see if I get the voice. You know what I mean? I'm driving the bus to Flavortown, baby. Love, peace, and taco grease.
Yeah. Do you think the people we regard as the great impressionists are actually nailing the voices the best? Or is it that they're expressing something the most comedically or getting an essence of the character that we love to hear?
There were some great impressionists who had crappy material.
Yeah.
they could do the voice, but it was like, okay, that's great. It's when you're able to merge really strong material with the voices, it kind of gives it that added value and hopefully gives you an insight into whoever you're impersonating. Daryl Hammond is a great example. One of the things he does with all of his voices, and Clinton's kind of the perfect one, I noticed every time he would adopt a character, he added something really – he put an edge on it. And his Clinton was kind of so sexual and, hey, how you doing? Good to see you. You know what I mean? He just added that kind of sexuality to Clinton that hadn't been there before. And I just thought, oh, that's great, because he put his stamp on each one of his voices and he does it so beautifully. And even with his Trump on SNL, he's kind of taken it and made it his own, in the sense that they make a suggestion to him and then his character, his Trump, adopts it as his idea.
Does Trump accent sound, because to me as a New Yorker, it's not a New York accent. It doesn't sound very New York, but I guess to other people it's like, oh, what a New York accent.
He has a New York accent maybe on like every fifth and seventh word, because there's something that he does. He kind of over articulates, but then he says, listen, you worked really, really hard, but you're fired. So it's on certain words, you hear the New York thing.
Yeah, fired, no R in there.
And there's also that crazy cadence that he has. And the only other person from Queens that I've ever heard with that was kind of like Christopher Walken, who has this very unusual way of speaking. And Trump has that very same kind of weird way of speaking. And when you kind of put the components together, that's Donald Trump. I have to tell you, doing a fantastic job, really.
I'll give you another one like that. Andrew Cuomo, our governor, he has that a little bit. So he definitely has a New York accent, but it's a little weird and it's a cadence. But I'll throw this out with Walken. I've heard interviews, I bet you have too, that the first thing he does when he gets a script is cross out all the punctuation.
Right.
When I heard that, I'm like, that's it. That unlocked every secret to how Walken talks
to me. And
probably the people you do don't offer you that kind of key in so often.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. But you know, for me, anytime I research anybody, like when I started doing Jay Leno, I'm doing good thing with everything. You know, because Jay Leno's getting a little bit of a lift. And his voice goes up and down. And originally, I think he was from Boston. And I listened to him. I was thinking, is there any Boston in there? Is there, you know, should I put it in somewhere? So I always try to do the research and find, you know, where this person's coming from, where they were born, how this affected them, and, you know, like, where are those little key components? So when I'm doing Trump and talking about him and how fantastic he is, really, I have to tell you, really fantastic, absolutely tremendous. And I make sure to put a little New York on at least some of the words. That way it's perfect.
Does doing a character, perhaps even, let me say, a loathsome character, make you like him or identify him with him more?
First off, my voice has gotten deeper and raspier recently because I'm doing him so much.
You're winning all the time. Winning's becoming
I'm
so
always
easy.
Winning. I'm just winning. I'm winning in the primaries, the caucuses. I'm winning with tall people, short people, and I'm doing very, very well with the poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. What's happening is I'm becoming a little more short and curt. It's because I'm doing him all the time, which is kind of funny. Like, wrap it up. Let's go. But I try to approach him as a actor approaching a character, and I try not to get too involved in the politics of it. I need to be agnostic so I can kind of play the middle of the road, because I play for large corporate audiences and I need the people who don't like Trump to like him and the people who already like him not to go over the top. So I have to ride it down the middle and keep the integrity of the character.
Now, I know with improvers are very collaborative. Mm-hmm. Stand-ups are really standoffish until you get to a certain level, then maybe they learn. What about you guys? What about the impressionist? Do you collaborate, or is it more this is mine, stay away from, or even like you're stealing the hook I had with my impression? What's the community like?
For the most part, within the impersonator community, you'll call somebody up and say, hey, how does this sound?
Yeah.
Am I close?
Yeah. So there's a new impersonation show. It's a competition show, I think, and people do the impersonations against each other like a blood sport. Is that really how we should be looking at impersonation?
Absolutely. It's a total blood sport. If you don't get it right, you should die. It should be dead on 100%. You know?
John DiDomenico is many, many people. Donald Trump is the one you hear on the Trump cast. And you want to plug what's a website?
JohnnyD.net, JohnnyD.net, or at JohnnyD23 on Twitter.
There you go.
On Twitter, which I'm on constantly. I'm constantly on Twitter. I'm huge on Twitter.
Tremendous. Tremendous. Terrific.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
And now the spiel, the jowls. On my show, Hang Up and Listen, I've talked about the tradition of the horrible baseball segue during radio ads. Sam Horn and Matt Shoemaker, both major league players and announcers, will shoehorn any sponsor's reference in, no matter how discordant, into a product placement. Yes, yes, yes. A call to the pen should, in fact, be sponsored by Verizon or Pac Bell or tonight's airing on Turner Movie Classics of Call Northside 777. Jimmy Stewart as reporter P.J. McNeil and Lee J. Cobb as his hard-bitten editor. And Rays hitter sure were biting hard on Nishak's breaking ball today. See, it's acceptable. That's all acceptable. That's all fine. As is, the Twins' offense is heating up, and Friedrich air conditioners will help you in these summer months. Or Jose Altuve sparking the Astros' offense, and AC Delco's shocks and struts can do the same for your Mark Melanson, such a dependable reliever. And dependable relief is Gas X. When that three-bean salad repeats like a Kyle Schwarber multi-home run game, it's Gas X. I accept all those. But for years, the Mets, my team, had a rather curious ad. You might say it was trying a little too hard. You might say it was just out of place on an MLB broadcast. You might say, why are these people buying radio ads at all? Here now from earlier this season.
Mets with a 3-1 lead on to protect it is Hansel Robles, just as Norman Seabrook and the Corrections Officers Benevolent Association protect and patrol the toughest precincts in New York. The jails, COBA, New York's boldest.
I suppose a positive media impression could help the bottom line of the prison guards, right? Come next contract negotiations, the public will associate the prison guards with all that is righteous and noble and a one-run lead in the eighth. I don't know. Maybe having the president of the prison guard's name be as familiar as Mets reliever Jerry's Familia, maybe that makes sense because I actually can't explain it. I don't know why it makes sense, but now it's all making sense. But now it all makes sense because we recently learned that when it came to magical Mets media moments, Norman Seabrook was a giver, but in so many other walks of life, he was simply on the take.
For 21 years, Norman Seabrook has been president of New York's Correction Officers Benevolent Association, or COBA. Today, he appeared in federal court on the other side of the law, facing corruption charges, led here, investigators say, by an abuse of power and greed.
In November 2013, Seabrook complained to a friend about working hard to invest COBA's money without any personal financial benefit, asserting that it was time that Norman Seabrook got paid.
Some further details. After putting $20 million of union funds in a high-risk hedge fund, according to the criminal complaint filed by the Office of the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, prosecutors say he was given $60,000. Delivered in a Salvatore Ferragamo bag, one of his favorite luxury brands. So I was keen to see if the Mets would still puff up the role of Mr. Seabrook in leading the jailers of New York in that toughest of precincts, the jails. So here's the tape. This is the first Mets game after Seabrook was arrested. I was listening to the part where they normally plug COBA, where they normally plug the jails. I hope they still give Norm a shout out. I hope they talk about New York's boldest. Here it comes.
So Familia coming on to protect the lead, just as the Corrections Officers Benevolent Association protect and patrol the toughest precincts in New York, the jails. COBA, New York's boldest.
Oh no! No Norman! See no Seabrook, say no Seabrook. They would broke no Seabrook. As the Mets announcers climb the ladder and set him down. And he has not been on a Mets broadcast since. Still, there are other references to the corrections officers, mentions big and small.
Billy Johnson on deck offering protection in the lineup, just as the Corrections Officers Benevolent Association protect and patrol the toughest precincts in New York, the jails, COBA, New York's boldest.
But there has been no full-blown shout-out to the disgraced former union head who once, to keep a prisoner from testifying against one of his officers, quote, single-handedly shut down the city court system by directing his members in a work stoppage that halted almost all the buses that ferry inmates to and from courts. But why? Why no ads, I say? This is an opportunity for the Mets announcers to really lean in. And now we've got Granderson on third, Conforto on second, Cespedes walking on his way to first. You could say that the bags are stuffed.
just like Norman Seabrook of the Corrections Officer Benevolent Association once stuffed $60,000 in cash into a Salvador Ferragamo bag. It was a clear RBI, riches before integrity, situation for the president of COBA, New York's ballsiest. Or how about, and with runners on, manager Terry Collins really walking a ledge here by leaving reliever Addison Reed in. Just like Norman Seabrook is allegedly guilty of honest services fraud and one count of conspiracy to commit honest services fraud. You know, according to the New York Times, Norman Seabrook once had one of his corrections officers dress as a cartoon character to mock a commissioner who was leading a tour of Rikers, which is exactly what Mr. Metz's job is whenever Chipper Jones came to Shea. Fine Mets tradition. Now, I know it's only wishful thinking to hope that they'll do this, to hope that the Mets announcers will still find time to honor the union chief. Maybe such a time can be when catcher Kevin Pilecki skillfully blocks a Jacob DeGrom fastball in the dirt. Just like Norman Seabrook blocked prison reform on notoriously harsh Rikers Island, standing in the way of ending solitary confinement, in effect, stranding the runner in a cell, alone, in contravention to the best human rights practices, confined to a dank cell, just as young hurler Steven Matz is confined to a pitch count of 105 in his starts. You know, Mets second baseman Neil Walker, ironically, has a walk rate of below 10%. Not much of a walker. Sort of like the president of the Corrections Officer Benevolent Association, is no longer president, is in no way connect, did not act out of benevolence, and associates with a dirty real estate developer now cooperating with authorities. Norman Seabrook, as union head, as respectable member of society, and as a mainstay on Mets broadcasts, he's out of here! That's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Mary Wilson, who has this idea for an awesome, awesome TV show, The Pope's Wacky Antics, yet she can't say it. She can't say Vatican sitcom. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lickteig, who has this great idea for a product that prevents chapping because like heals like. It's used with actual human body parts. And he would be able to sell this so easily if only he would bring himself to say the phrase, cannibal lip balm. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of the Panoply Network. All of these pronouncements have led for him, if he would just admit it, what he does every day upon hearing these credits, the gradual facepalm. The Gist, it's useful. We do it quite easily. And yet I can't bring myself to say it's full of practical aplomb. Umpru, depru, dupru, and thanks for listening. I'm going back to the park.